Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a poetry reading and discussion presented by the Boston University Center for the Humanities, the Department of English, and the literary journal AGNI. Speaking will be Scottish poet Don Patterson and Dan Chasen, poetry critic at The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. We begin with an introduction by Joseph Rezik, Assistant Professor of English at Boston University.
The conversation will be moderated by Dan Chasen, who received his PhD from Harvard in 2002 and has published three books of poetry, The Afterlife of Objects in 2002, Natural History in 2005, and Where's the Moon, There's the Moon in 2009. His writing has been honored by a fellowship from the Guggenheim Foundation, and he is currently a poetry critic or associate editor at The New Yorker, The New York Times Book Review, The New York Review of Books, and The Paris Review. He normally teaches poetry and writing workshops at Wellesley College, but BU has been lucky this year to welcome him as a visiting professor in the creative writing program. Before the conversations begin, I'd like to thank the individuals and departments who have made this event possible, including the Center for the Study of Europe with its executive director, Vivian Schmidt, the Boston University Center for the Humanities, the Department of English, and the literary journal, AGNI. It's worth noting, finally, that a conversation between our two guests began in print in 2010, when Chasen reviewed Patterson's book Rain for The New Yorker. In that review, Chasen described Patterson as, quote, a poet of surface gorgeousness who is nevertheless right at home in the dark. Let's see how that conversation continues. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. That's really nice. It's great to be here. Thanks to BU and to all the sponsors of this event. It's an honor, and for me a real personal pleasure, to welcome Don Patterson to BU. 15 years ago, when I discovered Patterson's work, I would have said he was among the very best new poets writing in the UK. The cunning, the technical swagger, the veiled, though radiant, intellect, these were the hallmarks of his art. A virtuoso art delighting in its own turns. It was, as the kids say, ridiculous. That period was capped by Patterson's extraordinary selected poems, The White Lie, published here by Grey Wolf in 2001. What followed has been one of the great decades any living poet has had, when Patterson published, among many other things, two books of original poems, Landing Light and Rain. It's part of, I think, his genius and wit that I don't know whether to put the emphasis in the title Landing Light on landing or light. It's either Landing Light or Landing Light, and they mean very different things. The latter book, Rain, which Joe just mentioned I reviewed in The New Yorker, is among the premier books of poetry by a contemporary poet, I think. Its title poem gives a taste of this work's chastised, run-down beauty. I love all films that start with rain, it begins. Then, later, however bad or overlong, such a film can do no wrong. So when his native twang shows through, or when the boom dips into view, or when her speech starts to betray its adaptation from the play, I think to when we opened cold, on a rain-dark gutter running gold with the neon of a drugstore sign. And I'd read into its blazing line, forget the ink, the milk, the blood. All was washed clean with the flood. We rose up from the falling waters, the falling rain's own sons and daughters. And none of this matters. There's something about Patterson's syntax, which is so flowing and pooling and kind of eddying in his stanzas, that it's impossible to stop, and it simply demands quotation at length. Quite apart from these tense, terse, pared-back poems, though feeding them through hidden channels, were the two books of aphorisms collected here as Best Thought, Worst Thought, also from Grey Wolf. These books are bottomless as a source of delight and wisdom, though I bet he's wincing internally to hear that word. They're a bountiful scripture for the grumpy, the wary, the hungover, the heartbroken. I can't resist reading a few of my favorite Patterson aphorisms. quote, falling and flying are near identical sensations in all but one final detail. We should remember this when we see those men and women seemingly in love with their own decline. Whenever he saw someone reading a Bible, he would spoil it for them by whispering, "He dies in the end, you know." I'm always tempted to do the same to anyone I see consulting their diary. All that moves is a ghost. And finally, the aphorism is a brief waste of time. The poem is a complete waste of time. The novel is a monumental waste of time. That last one suggests what's so paradoxical and moving about Patterson's art, its principled resistance even to its own claims, its way of planing its own rhetoric down to fit the square. And yet those words, brief, waste, time, monumental, if they ring a bell, it's because they conjure Shakespeare's sonnets. Patterson has written a ranging, funny, and powerfully personal book about those poems, Shakespeare's sonnets. His recent lexicon, seems to me, samples frequently from them. His work is a brilliant flexing of Shakespearean might. Don Patterson was born in Dundee, Scotland in 1963. He moved to London in 1984 to work as a jazz musician and has written poetry ever since. His work has garnered too many awards to list. He is now on the faculty of the University of St. Andrews, where he teaches poetry. Please welcome Don Patterson.
Thank you, Don, for that extraordinary introduction. I hoped it would never end. And it's wonderful to be here, and thanks especially to Elizabeth for inviting me back to Boston. It's always great to be back in this beautiful town. I'll try reading this thing, probably foolishly, because I only wrote it yesterday. And I wrote it at the airport, and I never write at the airport. I never write at all, to be honest with you, but at least of all at the airport, because I don't find the mixture of, in my case, gin and Xanax particularly conducive to... it has some weird effect on my cortex of informational disinhibition, you know. I think I'll call the poem My Incomprehension. I know what incomprehension means, it ain't that, but it's some, but they'll think I don't know. Anyway, an ego surf. What Patterson fails to realise is that his ideal reader died 50 years ago. What Patterson fails to realise is that there is a vast difference between the mere rehearsal of these tactics and their effective deployment. What Patterson fails to realise is that merely saying it does not make it so. What Patterson fails to realise is that, as Hill puts it, whatever strange relationship we have with the poem, it is not one of enjoyment. What Patterson fails to realise is that he would have found all this in Lucretius had he known to look. What Patterson fails to realise is that there is more to literary seriousness than merely shaving your head and affecting a recent bereavement. Ouch! What Patterson fails to realise is that a shorter would have been a far better book. What Patterson fails to realise is the magnitude of Olson's achievement. What Patterson's failed to realise is that he's become the poetic equivalent of White Van Man, British reference. What Patterson fails to realise is that he is no longer one of the Young Turks. What Patterson fails to realise is that he is no Paul Celan. Knew that. What Patterson fails to realise is that this is simply not the way poetry works. So I'm going to start low, with the plan that there book can only be one possible trajectory. So I'll keep it low for now. This is, again, fairly recent, a little squib, but it came out of a reading I attended a couple of months back in St. Andrews. I was forced to attend, and it was a fine reading. It was a very eminent visiting poet whose name will die with me. But it was one of those occasions when you started to kind of inwardly accept that a poetry reading isn't always a great night out. And the poems were fine. They were long, and they must have taken them ages. But the bits I really enjoyed were the introductions to the poems. And I found myself looking forward to these introductions increasingly, you know, with every poem. So it was really about that, about the introduction. Another friend of mine, an eminent Irish poet who will remain nameless, I once saw him give a reading that consisted, he stood up and he introduced a poem for 25 minutes. And he was a little the worse for the drink. And then sat down, having forgotten to read the poem. It was brilliant. Great. Anyway, it's just called Requests. Oh, tell us more about your dad, or why your second wife went mad, or how it was you had no choice but to give those men a voice. Sing that old Welsh lullaby you hush your kids with when they cry. Produce a boiled egg from your pocket, a flageole from your jacket. Expand on your idea that rhyme is gay, or tell us of the time you dropped your cell phone in the toilet. A joke, a bird call, please don't spoil it. Go on with your witty proem. Anything but read your poem. I should say, these are all new poems, I should say. I don't know why I should say that, but for reasons that I don't understand, they're all sonnets. I've just decided that I'm just going to make myself write sonnets for the next couple of years. Because I love the sonnet form, because on a good day I can rise to indifference. I feel quite annoyed with it, but they seem to happen to me a lot. So I'll read a few more of these and a couple of recent things. I have no idea what this poem is about. It's called Seven Questions About the Journey. Why are we leaving in such unreadiness? Your name was last. Is it too late to call? Is there still time to confess? The moment's past. If the weather is stormy, should we go nonetheless? None forecast. Where are our dogs and our horses? Can you guess? Slain, shot, gassed. How will we know when we reach our new address? Heed the blast. How do we look in our fine new leaving dress? Alone, aghast. Where are we going so light and riderless? Nowhere, fast. This next week poem is about a middle-aged concern that of which I'm having more of these days, and I now take siestas, because I read somewhere it was good for your heart to do that. Siesta is an aggrandizement. I fall asleep in the afternoon is what happens. It's supposed to be good for my heart, but what always happens is my heart destroys it for me, and it's just like, and I wake up, and I don't know if this happens to you, and I hate people that say that. Is it just me? But I wake up in a state of advanced kind of existential freakout 10 minutes later with my heart very loud in my ears. Having had the sense of somehow being cosmically misfiled, you know, in the wrong planet entirely. I mean, waking up suddenly as a kind of rather overweight, bald monkey with gravity problems, you know, and wondering how the hell I got here. So it's really about that. It's just called Here. I must quit sleeping in the afternoon. I do it for my heart, but all too soon my heart has called it off. It does not love me. If it down tools, there'd soon be nothing of me. Its hammer beat says you are, not I am. It prints me off here like a telegram. What do I say? How can the lonely word know who has sent it out or who has heard? Long years since I came round in her womb, enough myself to know I was not home. My dear sea up in arms at the wrong shore, and her loud heart like a landlord at the door. Where are we now? What misdemeanor sealed my transfer? Mother, why so far afield? I'll read two or three short poems from this last book, Rain, and then I think we'll have a conversation. Again, this is it's a poem called Two Trees, a poem I didn't understand necessarily when I wrote it. I didn't understand it at all, and I had to have the poem explained to me subsequently. It's kind of obvious to me now that it was a kind of an elegy for a man called Michael Donaghy, a very fine American poet, Irish-American poet, grew up in the Bronx, who came to Britain and was very popular and well-known over there, and was my dearest friend. Died far too young, 9 years ago. Two Trees. One morning, Don Miguel got out of bed with one idea rooted in his head: to graft his orange to his lemon tree. It took him the whole day to work them free, lay open their sides and lash them tight. For 12 months, from the shame or from the fright, they put forth nothing. But one day there appeared two lights in the dark leaves. Over the years, the limbs would get themselves so tangled up, each bough looked like it gave a double crop, and not one kid in the village didn't know the magic tree in Miguel's patio. The man who bought the house had had no dream. So who can say what dark, malicious whim led him to take his axe and split the bowl along its fused seam and then dig two holes? And no, they did not die from solitude. Nor did their branches bear a sterile fruit. Nor did their unhealed flanks weep every spring for those 4 yards that cost them everything, as each strained on its shackled root to face the other's empty, intricate embrace. They were trees, and trees don't weep or ache or shout, and trees are all this poem is about. I'll read 2 short poems. It's a poem called The Swing. It's a ballad. The swing was picked up for the boys, for the here and here to stay, and only she knew why it was I dug so solemnly. I spread the feet 2 yards apart and hammered down the pegs, filled up the holes and stamped the dirt around its skinny legs. I hung the rope up in the air and fixed the yellow seat and stood back that I might admire my handiwork complete, and saw within its frail trapeze the child that would not come of what we knew had 2 more days before we sent it home. I know that there is nothing here, no venue and no host, but the honest fulcrum of the hour that engineers our ghost. The bright sweep of its radar arc is all the human dream, handing us from dark to dark like a rope over a stream. But for all the coldness of my creed, and for all those I denied, and for all the others she had freed like arrows from her side, and for all the child was barely here, and for all that we were over, I could not weigh the ghosts we are against those we deliver. I gave the empty seat a push, and nothing made a sound, and swung between 2 skies to brush her feet upon the ground. I'll finish with a tiny wee poem called Correctives, which I recall writing, so it's definitely his epigraph. Correctives. A shudder in my son's left hand, he cures with 1 touch from his right. 2 fingertips laid feather light to still his pen. He understands the whole man must be his own brother, for no man is himself alone, though some of us have never known the one hand's kindness to the other. Thank you.
It was astounding, Don. Thank you. We've never met before, but we've corresponded a few times. Once I was back from some time in France, and I was sort of burdened by many affectations, one of which was drinking pastis. And I wrote to Don while drinking pastis, and he made me swear the stuff off. He said it was good for a day of pig farming in the Languedoc, but nothing more. And I never touched the stuff again.
I immediately warned you on that occasion because it sounded like you were my kind of guy, which you were drinking the last thing in the cupboard. You know,
so that's
the
only right. Time ever no, unfortunately, I'd stocked up on the pasties. It'd be the last thing in your cupboard. But, anyway, it was of all the things he's taught me, that's maybe the most valuable. But he sent me a newish poem, a sonnet, which I was just blown back by, and I wondered if you have it, you would read it. It's called The Big Listener.
I got it. Okay. Yeah, just a little bit of background. We were a bunch of us were commissioned by our beloved laureate. I don't know if a poet called Caroline Duffy, wonderful Scottish poet, and she was putting together an anthology, and we were all given a particular year, and she gave me 1997. And I wrote back to her and said, I can't think of a damn thing that happened in 1987 at all. Could I get 96? Because my dog died that year. You know, I could do a dead dog poem. And she said, no, 96 is gone. It's 97 and nothing, Patterson. So I racked my brain. It turned out it was just an act of suppression because I could remember what happened in 97, which was we voted in Tony Blair to power in the UK, having very little alternative. I bow to no man in my loathing of that individual. Let me be clear. My reasons are fairly straightforward. But the poem's called The Big Listener, because I always think if Tony was Stalin, that would be his Stalinist name, you know? The Big Listener. Because he thinks of himself as a kind of listening kind of guy, you know? His audience comes at a price, unfortunately. I should say the kind of mise-en-scene of this thing is certainly in Britain, this is enough to trigger the gag reflex, but it takes place in the Blair's bedroom. Okay. The Big Listener. Midnight, Connaught Square. A headlight beam finds Sherry just back from her speaking date. She looks at you, less animal of late. You lose no sleep but wake within a dream. Your favourite, that old divided dark, the white square at your neck, your good ear bent towards the long sighs of your penitent. You rinse 1,000 souls before the lark and wake refreshed, if somewhat at a loss as to why they seem so lost for words. They are your dead, who still rose to the birds the day we filled the booths and made the cross before you'd forced them, howling to their knees, to suffer your attentions. Spare us, please.
Can I ask you what went into that poem? What, besides loathing Tony Blair, it also has a kind of antagonistic relationship to this, to his memoir, is that right? Which was called A Journey, is that the name of the memoir?
I think it was originally my journey, but it's, or something like that. But I mean, that's unfortunate overtones, you know, my struggle, you know, mein shtick. I think it was changed wisely.
The name was changed.
I think so. Uh-huh. Yeah, and there's a particular passage when Sherry looks at him in that poem and says, "Less animal of late." There's a passage where he discusses slating his desire on Sherry in an animal fashion. Just an image I can never get out of my head. And you can't be forgiven for that, never mind a rack. So I have a lot to hold against him, mostly disappointment, because I remember that day in 97. We were walking the streets, I was down in London, and everyone was so happy, and we had such high hopes, and we were just lied to. And
I figured it's not the sort of poem that you would write about somebody you were always against, you know. Betrayed tone. He converted to Catholicism, did he?
He did.
Yeah.
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 Which is fine. That's grand. I mean, most of my best friends have some religious belief, although I have none. But But he does believe himself to be the font of liberal wisdom.
Yes. When you are writing these sonnets, what's in your head? What music is in your head? Shakespeare, I would imagine. Is there anything you can put your finger on that's working in your ear?
Not really. I mean, there used to be, but I mean, I think the good thing about writing lots of sonnets, and I haven't thought about them a lot, is they become an empty form after a while. So it's just, you don't really notice the form anymore. It's pretty much like if you played jazz, if you're working off, that's what I used to do and still do occasionally, if you're working off a set of changes as a jazz musician, you don't think about the changes because you've learned them well enough to ignore them and take the corners and just play what you hear. The sonnet works pretty much the same way. I guess the same as a fugue for a classical musician.
Yeah.
You don't really think about the form.
Do you write them rapidly?
Or? No, really slowly, with tweezers.
Yeah.
over a period of years.
Uh-huh. So you're working on them over a period of years with tweezers. It's not as though they're welling up and then suddenly they come very quickly.
No. The first draft comes quickly, but yeah. I think a lot of people who work in form have this experience, which is that you get a first draft really quickly that at least has the DNA of the final thing there, and that's what you're then working towards. So you get 5-6 lines for nothing, and you think, hey, this is going to be easy, and then you stop. and then you have to make them up.
Is it already a sonnet in the first draft?
These days it is, because, foolishly I've set myself this kind of project, but you can often tell.
It's been done before with excellent results.
I think you can tell quite early what a poem wants to be when it grows up. Yeah. Never wants to be a sestina, interestingly, but hey, sestinas.
Do you think of the sonnet as having a particular subject matter or territory attached to it? I mean, it's... strikes me that there have not been that many political sonnets. Milton's poem about the late massacre at Piedmont, Lowell wrote a lot of political sonnets, but it seems, I don't know, just a sort of cursory scan of my brain, it doesn't turn up a ton of political sonnets.
Yeah, I think it's too short for polemic. It's too short for long argument, or anything with much in the way of nuance. And I mean, I think you can't. It's an argumentative form, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I think you're working towards a nice, balanced kind of cool quadratic equation rather than anything longer. And maybe that's a subject that's not particularly suited for that kind of odd lyric form. But no reason why not. It's an empty form, so I don't even believe that. I think you can turn them towards anything where you can identify that motif. But they just echo a particular form of human thought, which is this, that, so, this. That's all a sonnet does, really.
So if a poem came to you that these days that wasn't a sonnet, would you suppress it, or would you put it in another drawer, or what would you do? I mean, how much are you committed to writing a book that's entirely sonnets?
Well, just perversely, just entirely so, and I don't know what would happen, but I mean, the good thing about midlife, I find, is that one is rarely inspired at all, so I mean, I would like to think of myself as batting away these brilliant poems that weren't sonnets, but it hasn't really come up so far. So it would be cool if it happened.
And are they all the same all the same rhyme scheme, as we say? This one has a three ABBA quatrains and a couplet.
They're all different. They're all different. Which is an idea I just stole from. I did a version of Rilke's. Rilke's Rilkit. I have no idea. Rilke, Die Sonette an Orpheus. And which is a lexicon of possibilities of the sonnet form. So there are lots of different kinds of sonnets coming out. Some thin, some pentameter. Weird rhyme schemes, what have you.
Yeah. Just let me ask you a couple of questions about politics and the responsibility you may or may not feel to politics when you're writing poems. First of all, do you feel any responsibility to any given subject matter at any given time? Do you feel I am experiencing X and Y, therefore I must write about it? Do you feel the pressure of life events? Or would you say that writing a poem is completely intuitive and like a bolt of lightning? Those are very far apart alternatives, perhaps something
somewhere
in the middle.
Between the two.
Yes, right.
It's a good question. I think the only thing is, for me, is that self-consciousness is the death of art. Basically, you don't make yourself write anything. But, on the other hand, you can put yourself in the line of fire for some things, you don't force yourself to write about them, but I think it's probably your responsibility to react to your entire environment, part of which is political, inevitably, and take stock of that too. And I think if you're open to that, then you'll feel moved to write stuff about it. I'm worried when it becomes a self-conscious project, because one sees this in political poetry all the time. Mm-hmm. It suffers especially badly from that kind of self-consciousness, hideously so, actually. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, actually, of an example. Because I was talking to someone about this, and it was like, people often use it as an excuse to get a poem that they haven't won for themselves. Sort of a custody interrogation of the etymology of a job title. It's like you have to make things, you have to make them up. You can't just steal them, either from yourself or from anyone else. But very often the political, I think, people think that affords them material, subject matter. Well, it doesn't, You still got to make it up. And I was remembering a few years back, and it was the middle of the Bosnian crisis in the early 90s, and there was a terrible story came out of Sarajevo, heartbreaking, about a Muslim and a Christian couple. She was Muslim, he was Christian. Is that right? They were called Bosco and Admira. and they had to conduct this clandestine affair, you know, through the desire paths of Sarajevo. Another word poet picked up on immediately was desire paths. That was everywhere that year. You know, so that should have been in the ban list immediately, along with Shard, Myriad, and the other one, Maramgrass. But anyway, so but there was a terrible end to this story, and this couple died on a bridge in Sarajevo, and there was a picture of that in the newspaper, and their arms were outstretched and their fingers were touching, and they'd been shot by snipers trying to meet up. Unbelievable tragedy and human poetry in this, but the point is you can't improve on that kind of thing. It was a and everyone tried it, you know, and you were sitting there with your watch going, I'll give them 10 minutes before the poems start pouring in, and sure enough a week later my inbox, the papers were full of these lousy poems about Bosco and Edmina. I thought it was incredibly stupid and presumptuous thing to do, to think that you could add any more poetry to that situation than already been here, you know. And I think that's the big danger of political poetry, is that your chances are that you're saying something that's superfluous. There's no point in you trying to provoke feelings of which people are already in high possession from the mere encounter with the documentary facts, you know. If that moves them, you're not going to improve on that, you know. So that's what I mean about it's a difficult area. If you're going to come in and make stuff up, your approaches have to be oblique and original, and you have to find a way of, you know, breaking and remaking that stuff in the crucible of the imagination the same way you do with any other subject matter. So it's difficult.
It's fascinating. What does American poetry look like to you from your vantage point? Who are your favorites and who are your most despised? And
oh, it looks
present company.
It looks great. It looks great. I mean, it's just, and I think it's, as much as one doesn't want to concede the point, I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, the last 50 years, you know, or the last 70 years, it's actually longer than that. You know, the great poetry has been coming out of America and not the UK. We've had some high points, but I mean, I think when I think of my favourites, you know, I can't get past Bishop, you know. Kind of get past O'Hara's a wonderful poet. I mean, they're so various, you know. Wilbur is a wonderful poet, you know. Merrill was an amazing poet, you know. So many great poets, you know. And if I were to name, I could maybe get, you know, I could name 20 in a heartbeat, and I would only put forward 3 or 4 from the UK as being in the same bracket. So the truth is, you won that one, I think, you know. So
does Frost matter to you?
He matters so much I forgot to mention him. It's just, I think of Frost as being a kind of global presence like Rilke, really, and therefore sort of transnational in a way, really. You know, I don't think of him as being anybody's. He's too great.
That's ironic, because he was regarded as the sort of quintessence of a regional poet in his, by people who didn't like him in his life. I knew that he was, from reading your work, that he's very valuable inspiration for you. Do you think across the board he's a poet that's read and admired across the English-speaking world?
I think so. I think increasingly so as well. Of course, we saw that dreadful fall from favour, you know, sort of, you know, through the 60s, 70s and early 80s. But now I think the stock's rising again with Frost, as people see that he may have sounded simple, but he was very complex and a nuance, you know, and the complexity of his propositions and the depth of the thinking there is really extraordinary. Yeah. Once you get past Frost and his own human neurosis, you know, and all that sort of stuff you've got to fight through, but underneath that, extraordinary mind, I think, you know.
I agree. At some point, elegantly, this will spill over into the audience, and some of you will ask questions, so I invite you to think of some. I'm just curious about American poets. What about Stevens to you? Sometimes Stevens and Frost are opposed. They thought of one another as, I think, opposites of temperament, opposites of situation. There's a famous story where Stevens says to Frost says to Stevens, your problem, Stevens, is you write bric-a-brac. And then Stevens says to Frost, your problem, Frost, is you write subjects.
Ouch.
I know, right? they were both right, but neither was a problem, you know.
I know, but that's what's so cool about the American poetry is you're always having these crazy fights, you know, between a raw and a cooked, you know, and sort of and O'Hara and Lowell going at it, you know, right. It's brilliant. We never get that, we're not excitable enough, you know. Maybe we don't take it seriously enough to think it's worth fighting about. But yeah, Stevens, I don't know. Certainly the way he played out in the UK was really unfortunate. This could get boring quick.
It's funny, I'm riveted. Say more.
Yeah. You know, the problem with Stevens is not Stevens. The problem with Stevens is his epigones, you know. The trouble, and Dylan Thomas was the same, although he's a much smaller poet than Stevens, who was a genius. But the trouble is, these people people imitate the things that are most easy to imitate in Stevens and Dylan Thomas, which is their affectation.
So Stevens sponsors a kind of empty avant-gardism, a sort of indeterminacy for its own sake, or is that
beautifully put? I mean, it's just there was a whole movement called the Apocalyptics, which was a low point in British verse in the 1940s. The Apocalyptics wrote apocalyptic poetry, and it was very much from a kind of late misreading of harmonium, and this kind of affected, ridiculous sort of fake surreal rubbish, for which Thomas and Stevens were entirely to blame, and we lost 10 years of poetry. In fact, we had some great poets who wrote in that style and later had to disavow it. A Scottish poet called Norman Mackay, a very decent poet, who wrote two books in the Stevens / Thomas style that he just pulped, bought every copy and set fire to them. You know, it was a terrible time for poetry.
Brings up the most sort of the preeminent American poet of the last 50 years here, which is John Ashbery, and I wondered what you think of him.
Well, you know,
I started off
with problems with Ashbery, but yeah. I was young and stupid and I hadn't read widely enough. And now that I can see Ashbery as part of a longer tradition. And also, having read the language poets and all these guys, after sitting down reading... I'm not going to name names, I'm too nice a guy. You know who I mean.
Remember, this will end up on YouTube. These are immortal.
I'm very much cognizant of that.
Okay. Good.
But after that experience, one re-embraces Ashbery as a brother in the English lyric tradition, frankly, which I believe he is. And actually, younger poets have helped make a lot of sense of Ashbery for me. I'm thinking of people like Timothy Donnelly here, and what he's taken from Ashbery and how he's moved that into something I can understand better. And he's provided a way for me to go back to Ashbery and see what I was missing because of my own blind spots. So it's kind of interesting the way that the next generation can often make sense of the previous one if you're outside it all.
It's so hard to write a good poem, whatever the mode, and it seems to me that often what young poets pick up is the mode without any sort of gift or talent, and the mode writes itself, so that you have the Ashbery offspring and the Stevens offspring. Mm. But a great poet is a great poet, whatever the mode. Yeah. Are there questions from the crowd for Don?
So appreciate you coming over here to speak with us. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Besides Google, which seems to find you incomprehensible, what are the things that get under your skin today out of the political, social, economic sphere? Is it the bankers? Is it rescuing Greece? Is it, I don't know, is it creationism? What is it that causes you to want to write that next poem that comes out in 14 lines but is piquant?
I don't know if it's any of those things, to be honest with you. I mean, it's just, I guess all the same things that make you annoyed, It's just, I do have a wide circle of contempt. I mean, don't get me wrong, There's many things that I could drag in there. Bankers, Lord. But where's the poetry in that, I guess there's somebody writing about that stuff. I think the thing is, again, is your strong feelings aren't sufficient. Poems are made of words, and unless you've got a couple of words to rub together, you got nothing. And unfortunately, your strong feelings about something are no guarantor of anything at all. So it doesn't matter how up in arms I might be about, the economic situation at the moment, or Greece, or our own political situation in Scotland is very interesting at the moment as well. That's changing constantly. None of these, unfortunately, necessarily provide any inspiration, you know, which does and probably should remain mysterious, you know. So that's a lousy answer, but it was an honest one. But lots of things get me upset, but let's not get started right now. So we'll be here all night.
Yes. I know Emily Dickinson is not a particularly political poet, unless you consider a Whig in post-Whig America political. But have you formed any impressions of her poetry?
Of Dickinson?
Yes.
Impressions, both certainly. It's someone I've been reading for years, someone I've tried to imitate slavishly as a younger poet. I mean, I know Dickinson really well. I don't know how you could not. I don't know how you could avoid it, or why you would want to. I think she defines what the exercise should be, which is you have the sense in every poem of her own questing towards something she doesn't fully understand. And I've always taken that as a kind of touchstone. You know, you mustn't know what you're going to write. You mustn't sit down with an idea that it's going to be about X, that you're going to arrive to such and such a conclusion. You sit down with a hunch, with an itch. You don't know where it's going to go, but you know you're going to use the poetic form itself as a way of leading you towards that weird synthesis of two things that you think will fit together, but you just don't know how. And you have the sense of Dickinson doing that in every single poem somehow, which is just extraordinary, you know. And for her, it's about self-delighting. It's all about surprising herself. And as we know, and as Frost said, you know, unless you do that, you don't surprise anyone else. So she always reminds me of what it's about. When I forget what poetry is supposed to do or be about, then I'll read Dickinson, you know, always, yeah.
I wonder about Robert Lowell. I hate to turn this into just a throwing names at you sort of event, but what Robert Lowell's reputation could not have been higher, you know, 30, 40 years ago in the United States, and now he's, I think, really sadly barely read, and when he is, he's not well liked. What do you feel about Lowell?
In the UK, it's a matter of total incomprehension that you allowed Lowell's reputation to sink this low.
Yeah.
We've had two big books come out, you know, which I think you've had over here as well, which are the letters and the collected poems. But when we learn, I mean, recently, again, because of really lousy stewardship of the estate, is that libelous? Maybe I'll have to cut that. he was out of print, I believe.
Yes.
Which just is staggering. You would allow a poet of that stature, you know, so central to your culture, you know, to fall out of print. It's just absolutely breathtaking.
But even the anthology pieces that were never out of print, are when students encounter them, they have a very hard time. You know, when my students at Wellesley encounter them, they have a hard time seeing why they're special. It's a mystery to me. I don't know why, and I feel that I never teach Lowell very well. Students don't want to hear that much about aristocrats from Boston and their problems, and I haven't figured out a way to package his... I think he's profound.
Well, I think that's exactly the point, but I mean, I think that's the hard thing to teach, and it comes down to that thing again, which is you have to get past the subject matter because it's not really important.
Right.
Because in poetry, subject matter is pretext, you know, and unfortunately, in Lowell's case, the subject matter sometimes, you know, which is, you know, Bram in Boston is a difficult pretext to get past. But I think once you push through that and teach people that this is not what the poem is about. Mm-hmm. At all, it doesn't really matter. You know, all that stuff is just is surface noise. He's a deep and
A mentor of mine. I won't name her, but a great lover of Lowell and a great writer on Lowell at Harvard. I once was going into some overly abstract theories about why Lowell was not read anymore. She sort of tolerated them, and then she chimed in with, "It's probably just because he's a misogynist," which is. Maybe right.
Yeah, there are many unfortunate, you know, sort of, yeah, but I mean, this is the problem, isn't it? It's just, I think it's a sentimental age in that regard. We had the same thing in the UK with Larkin, who, after the letters came out, his reputation plummeted, as if because we now realised he was a sort of, you know, one aspect of him, which was a needy part that always sought to kind of, you know, echo the you know, the style of his interlocutor, that well, part of him was misogynist, part of him was unpleasantly right-wing and racist, you know, and things that are unforgivable, you know, at least an aspect, you know, of his character, that somehow we should suddenly find the poems rubbish overnight that we thought were fine. Why couldn't the poems have merely represented the best of that man and the letters the worst? People are complicated, you know, and what, you know, which of our lives would stand up to the same kind of scrutiny? So I think we're very sentimental about reading the work through the biography, and we'll have to stop, I think, you know. They relate. Let's not pretend that they don't. God knows we don't want to get back to New Criticism again. That was a big mistake. But you have to read it as a complex continuum, you know, and people are really complicated. You know, you can read the work as separate, you know, and in the light of the biography. You just don't simplify. Sorry. And so on.
Back to you and your work. I am thinking about the difference between reading and hearing, and felt that there was a quiet power in the way that you came across, part with your reading, partly because of the chatting in between, which was self-effacing or somehow so different. And I'm wondering if you ever find that when you have written a poem and it's frozen, I mean, it's what it's going to be, and you read it, that you find it hard to re-inhabit it, particularly if other people have become enthusiastic about it, repeat it a lot, or you see it around you and people clap for it or whatever. Do you ever sort of lose the plot with that?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I think I very often just stop reading that poem when that happens, you know, when I don't feel in touch with it in that way at all, you know, even though you know it's kind of one of your greatest hits and you should really drag it out again. It's just at some point it becomes petrified in a way that you just can't. It just becomes a series of noises, you know, like a little bit of choreography for your tongue, you know. And even though you've even fossilized the cadences that make it sound like you're meaning it and feeling it when you're just not, you know. And I think when that happens, you're in danger of being just openly insincere and should probably stop reading the poem. It's why it's hard to read the last book but one. You know, it's easier to go back to early stuff because there you've got a chance to surprise yourself. But that's very difficult.
You can re-inhabit. I mean, you can drop and then it returns to life.
Some of them do, but of course these poems change as you do, and some are simply no longer relevant to you, and you no longer believe what they're saying. But some you reinterpret in the light of your experience, you know, and there's still something in them for you. But at the end of the day, I don't think one should lose track of the fact that you're trying to give this stuff away and not keep it. So for me personally, you don't want audiences to associate these poems with your particular voice. For me, they're not. They're about trying to get these things to leave the house and not hold on to them. So it's a paradoxical activity reading poems, because essentially in some ways it's just a sales pitch for the book. But on the other hand, you know that people enjoy hearing you read them, so it's really difficult to know how to pitch it.
Could I also ask then, is once it's out, does it ever become something that you really see as belonging to others and not to yourself any longer?
I had a very strange conversation last year and a couple of years back, and a woman came up after a reading and she said to me, "I just wanted to thank you for a particular poem that you wrote that meant an awful lot to me and my husband when we were courting. You know, we used to read this poem out and I just wanted to say thanks for writing it." And I said, "Well, that's very kind of you to say. What was the poem?" I asked. And she said, "No, it's okay. It's nothing. I just wanted to say thanks." And I pressed her on this. I said, "No, go on, tell me what was it? I'd be interested to know what the poem was." And she said, "No, really, it was. I just wanted to say thanks, and it was just meant a lot to me. But that's all good to me, you know." But idiotically, I went on, you know. I said, "Go on, tell me what the poem was." And she snapped at me, and she said, "It's none of your business." and I thought, "Yeah, you're right," you know. And I was a little hurt at the time, but I thought it's a kind of a compliment, you know, because if you know, if someone feels so passionately about it that they don't want to share it with you, that's, I guess.
What do you think of the claim that you cannot have ethnic violence without poetry?
That you can't without poetry?
Yes.
I don't know.
Ethnic violence?
Yes.
Could you explain? Sorry.
So you need poetry in order to convince perpetrators of ethnic violence that they're able to do what they should do.
I think that's a really good point, and I think it's and I think what we always have to appreciate is that rhetoric is neutral, and you know, and these charismatic individuals can turn that poetic rhetoric, you know, for you know, to good or evil. You know, and wherever you you find that kind of violence, you often find a brilliant rhetorician using it for evil. And we know that, that Hitler studied the speeches of Lloyd George for exactly that reason. So I think your point is a good one.
I'm a PhD student currently studying Thoreau, Emerson, and Whitman, the great transcendentalists. What are your opinions about the, I guess, the transcendentalist movement of the 19th century?
This is usually when I wake up screaming, you know, with, you know, and at this point I look down and I don't have any trousers. I think they're great. Emerson, yeah. I think a little misread Emerson, especially in his remarks on poetry, were rather misinterpreted. And, you know, in the way that Whitman spun off those, I think was misreading. But I think that's probably something I can expand on in the bar. I can get boring on this very quickly.
Are you reading Emerson's poems?
Yeah, we're doing kind of the trans... Well, I love Thoreau, so...
Oh, he's great, yeah. Yeah, I have nothing but enthusiasm. That's a terrible answer. I'm sorry.
Thank you all. There's a reception, and thank you, Don Patterson.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a poetry reading and discussion featuring Scottish poet Don Patterson and Dan Chasen, poetry critic at The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. Tonight's event was presented by the Boston University Center for the Humanities, the Department of English, and the literary journal AGNI. We began with an introduction by Joseph Rezek, Assistant Professor of English at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Leidonis. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.